So I'm going to tell you some new results about the self-interacting dark matter model. This is a model where you allow particles to scatter off of each other. For this talk, it's just elastic scattering. And on large scales, this actually doesn't do anything. It looks exactly the same as the cold dark matter model. And this is essentially what Spergel and Steinhardt said back in 2000, that when you look in the inner parts of galaxies, so specifically within sort of the NFW scale radius, you start to see a deviation from standard cold dark matter predictions. Otherwise, everything looks pretty much the same. And just as a simple model to have at the back of your mind, just think about the dark matter as being some hidden neutron. So we know that, for example, the neutron-proton cross-section is sort of 20 bonds at low velocities and starts falling off. And it's kind of interesting to think of this in terms of astronomy, that those are the scales probed by merging clusters, and those are the rotation curves. We heard a lot about them, and you'll hear a lot more now. This is the regime where we'll be testing this model. The model is really simple. For the purposes of what I'm going to do here, we're thinking about galaxies. There's really no need for velocity dependence from the data, so we'll just assume it's a constant cross-section. Okay, it's a few centimeters squared per gram, so a few bonds per GeV. The nice thing about this is when you hit this regime, the qualitative predictions don't really change. And if I get to it right at the end, I'll show you a plot. The typical predictions don't change whether you're at 1 or 2 or 3 or even 10 centimeters squared per gram. They become very insensitive for a very good reason. It has to do with the temperature profile of CDM halos. Also, when you jack this up to a few centimeters squared per gram, you become very insensitive to the star formation history just because the dark matter wants to drive towards the equilibrium solution. So what you really care about at the end of the day is what the baryons are distributed as now rather than how they got there. Okay, so it's a very predictive model in that sense. It's a model where now you can actually make predictions just based on a simple analytic model. And that's the virtue of having a large cross-section. Okay, so you still need feedback and everything else in galaxy formation to like give you the right stellar mass, halo mass relation. You still need to put galaxies in the right halos. But then the halos itself, they don't care so much about the star formation history. They just care about, okay, what kind of a galaxy is in that halo. I wasn't going to show this, but one way to think about issues on small scales, and this came up now, so I just put this plot in, is this diversity we've been talking about in rotation curves. And for me, the interesting thing is that is something that Stacy mentioned, which is that when you see rotation curves like this, they are the lowest surface brightness galaxies. Okay, and it's not something that this is something that's been puzzling me for a long time. There was this paper, James I and with a student Greg Martinez and a postdoc Rachel Cusio-Duneri, we wrote this paper, and the title of that paper was "The Case Against Warm and Self-Interacting Dark Matter Model," and the thought then was, if you look at these halo, I mean, these are not small galaxies. These are 100 kilometer per second galaxies. And this is a measurement of their core density. You know, it's not so much about whether there's cores or cusps. It's really about the density of dark matter in the central parts of the halo. If you look at the core density, and this box is sort of a measure of the error bar, you can see that there's a huge scatter here, right? About an order of magnitude or more. And it was just hard for me to see where you get the scatter from. And at that time, Stacy had by the time already realized that it's not a random scatter. If you in this case, the lowest surface brightness galaxies are the ones with the lowest core densities. The higher surface brightness galaxies are the highest surface densities. So it's really hard to see how that comes about if you're going to try and take this seriously, the data at face value, and try to predict it. Now in SIDM, this diversity is already built in. And I'll say towards the end that it's not really you don't want to think of it as diversity, as such, but the diversity is already built in because the core sizes in SIDM can be anywhere from, so this is basically a measure of core size, and this is Vmax, can be anywhere from something like RS, which is the NFW scale radius, down to where the stars are, which is, I've just taken 1.5% of the R200, right? When you get down to this scale, the dwarf galaxies, things become really difficult because all of these scales merge, right? And anybody's model will fit this. Right? It's not that hard to like make things work. And you know, you might like say there are distance errors, inclination errors, and like, you know, things may go away. This model or any such model is only interesting if it's going to explain just the whole thing, right? So it's a very ambitious thing. I'm going to say that, you know, every single rotation curve that's out there is going to be explained by just this one single parameter, this cross section over mass. Okay, so a couple of slides about the physics. The physics is very simple. On the left, you see a plot of the temperature of the dark matter, so RMS velocity versus radius scaled out by this NFW scale radius, and here's the density versus radius. Just focus on the black and the blue, and essentially when you turn on collisions, you're allowing heat to transfer from outside in. See, this is the temperature profile. Things are colder inside in NFW halos than they are outside, and then it becomes roughly isothermal. And when you turn the scattering, what happens is you transfer some heat inside, the halo becomes roughly isothermal there, and you push the particles from here out there, right? And that's the formation mechanism. But the interesting thing is, like, you have to ask what happens when there's actually a reasonable amount of baryons sitting in these halos. What happens to the prediction there? One key thing here is this region where the particles on average have had one or more interactions, that's what becomes isothermal. Right here, right? And then this basically stays the same as the lambda CDM prediction, so it's sort of NFW, right? So a very simple model, which seems to work really well in describing these halos that you see in simulations, is that it's isothermal in the inner part, which is that exactly, okay? And at some radius R1, beyond that, it basically turns into what it is in lambda CDM. Now this R1, for a few centimeters square per gram, is generically RS, the scale radius of the NFWs, okay, or something of that order. The temperature is essentially set by the Vmax of the halo. Okay. So basically, it's a very simple, well-described model. If you know what the outer profile of the dark matter is, everything inside is fixed. So if you tell me what the NFW, you pick a halo from a simulation, you tell me what the rho s and rs, or Vmax and rmax for the NFW halo is, everything else gets fixed. It gets fixed as long as you also tell me what the baryons in there are. Because when you jack up the density of the baryons, more importantly, when you jack up, you know, how concentrated the baryons are in the center, that changes the potential here. This potential is the potential of everything that's gravitating, the baryons and dark matter. And so when you jack up the density of gas and stars, you basically get, you know, you can get whatever you want. I mean, you can get cores, you can get, you know, in extreme cases, you can get cuspy halos. In the other limit where this is completely negligible, you get core sizes that are large, you know, maybe half an RS or something like that. Okay, and that's just illustrated here in this plot from doing the same thing that Kyle Oman did, which is plotting V2 KPC versus Vmax and seeing the scatter. And these points are basically, you see the scatter here because the radius, the scale radius of the stars is changing. You're making things more concentrated. The dark matter density goes up. You make the stars less concentrated, the dark matter density goes down. And you can see that in detail in rotation curves. Let me just show you this one example here. The magenta lines are the stars and the gas. The stars here, the blue stars here, are what would happen if you neglected the presence of the baryons. You add the baryons, so you take into account that the baryons contribute to the gravitational potential, and that's what happens to the dark matter. Right. It's just the isothermal solution. The outer part is completely fixed. Right. So to the extent that you know what the concentration of this halo is, there's no more free parameters. It's just completely fixed there. Okay, so you can go and try to do this for a large sample. And the idea here was not to look at galaxies one by one. It's just to take the spark sample and say that, you know, clearly there's going to be issues with some data. Clearly there's distance errors and inclination errors. What we wanted to see was if we fit them all, what would the scatter look like? What would be the output of this model? Because it's such a, you know, it's well described. The model, you know, is very simple. And here's the fit, okay, to galaxies. This is 80 kilometers per second. This is about 140, 150 kilometers. This is, you know, very large galaxies. You can see the huge ranges of different rotation curves, right? And what this is telling you is that there's enough freedom in this model to fit all of them, right? But what's interesting is, what do you need to actually fit them? Okay, and I'm going to try and give you some plots for that. So, Stacy talked about this. One way to see the rotation curves is at some fixed radius. If you look at it, it looks like just a scatter plot. It looks like there's so much diversity going on there. But there's another way of maybe putting it on this plot, which is sort of the observed acceleration versus the baryonic acceleration. That seems to indicate that they lie in this sort of narrow locus here, almost like a one-dimensional line. And so that's a way to see the uniformity in these rotation curves. Okay, what happens when we fit the with SIDM? And that's what you get. Okay, now there's a lot of things to say about this. If I told you that the rotation curves have been well fit, then you shouldn't be surprised that I get this out. Okay, every single rotation curve gets fit really well with this model, so it's not a surprise. But what this is showing you is actually very interesting. It's showing you the total acceleration versus the baryonic acceleration for the model. Okay, so what it's showing you is what is the SIDM prediction in this plane. It's not a line. No, that's the bond line that best fits, you know, that was in Lely et al. That Stacy showed. Yeah. Sigma over M. For all of these, it's fixed to 3 cm² per gram for this case. But if you change to 4 or 5 or 1, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, but it's been fixed because there's no way to really measure sigma over M with these galaxies. And that has to do with the fact that we don't have any independent measures of the outer halo in these systems. If you knew what the outer halo looked like for some of these galaxies, these 10 to the 11 solar mass galaxies, then you would be able to measure the cross section, but you can't do that here. So this is not a theory with like, which is a line in this plane. It has some intrinsic scatter. It's only 0.1 dex, but it does have. And that scatter is required to actually fit the data, and it does so really beautifully. Okay, I'll come back to this in a second. So that's the same fit. So what do we need to do? Well, here's the distribution of the mass-to-light ratios for SIDM in blue, and the same distribution for the Mon fits that we redid. They look identical, the mass-to-light ratios, and this is where it should be, around 0.4 in the 3.6 micron band. Okay, and this is not an input in a sense, it's just when we do the MCMC, this is what comes out. In a lot of cases, the data, the rotation curves themselves pick out the mass-to-light ratios for the galaxies. What about the chi-squares? How well do they do? So here's the chi-square per degree of freedom for Mon versus SIDM. Right? And this is not to say, you know, Mon's horrible. You know, it does an amazing job for like, you know, just putting in M over L, the mass-to-light ratio of the stars, and just fitting it. Okay, but there are many cases where it just doesn't do a good job. Okay, and you need the scatter that's inherent in this in essentially hierarchical structure formation models to get it right. And you can see some of them here. Right, you do phenomenally well in SIDM in many cases, and that's just telling you that there's scatter in the data. You know, is SIDM, so SIDM is different from Mond, but it actually sort of gives you Mond in a broad brush sense. And for me, this plot is actually really interesting because it's showing you the same data, but not binning it. Because I haven't binned this data anymore, okay, like Larry et al. Did, okay? And there's good reasons to bin the data, but there's also good reasons to look at the data. This is the same curves where you're looking in the outer parts of the galaxies. So R greater than 2R disk. And this is R less than 2R. I've done nothing. I've just fixed the mass-to-light ratio to be 0.5 and done nothing else. Okay? And you can see that the ordered uniformity is really coming from the outer path, right? And this, now you could claim that the line is actually that, okay? And what's happening is something scattered up and down, either because you've gone, you know, you've got the wrong value of M over L, or maybe there's some inclination errors that move them up and down, or distance errors that move them sideways in this way. Right? That's possible, right? But what I would look at this and say is that it's just not clear that the accelerations in the inner part for the same baryonic acceleration is exactly the same, or has to be exactly the same in the inner and the outer parts, right? If this was, if this, I don't know, I think I've sort of made that point. And in SIDM, it's not, okay? You really need that fine difference to match, to actually fit the rotation curves really, really well. Okay, what do you need to put in? So the only prior that we put in, and it's a very weak prior, you can think of it as sort of regularizing the fits, is that the concentration mass relation has to lie along this thing. Okay, we put it in as one data point. So in many cases, the rotation curve might have hundreds of data points. So if the real answer isn't anywhere here, it doesn't have to lie here. Okay, this is the only kind of fit I know of where you basically are bang on. So this is the Dutton et al. Concentration mass relation. That's what you need to fit the rotation curves and get the M over L values. Right? What happens with the stellar mass halo mass relation? This is an output. Okay, there's no prior here. I'm not putting anything in. Right? This is what you get out, and that's the Baruzzi result. In a sense, you shouldn't be surprised. This is one of the success. On the large scales, when you go to the outer parts of galaxies, lambda CDM does work amazingly well, right? But that's just very comforting to see that we're not assuming, or we're not putting something into a fits that wouldn't be consistent with sort of galaxy formation as a whole, okay?
What's the
NCMC? Oh, sorry. This is just a full NCMC scan. That's the MS, and the CS is more like we control the fit and try to get the concentration mass to lie as close to this as possible. But in the other case, it's just allowed to just vary. Right? We just wanted to see exactly if you did the fit in a controlled way, what would happen. This is the baryonic telefisher relation. And if you're interested, the best fit line we get is not V to the fourth. There's a lot of scatter in the MCMC because that's just the error from fitting to the data. Okay, we haven't gone through and asked what would be the intrinsic error, but it is some correlation here, and that's something that needs to come out of galaxy formation. So the last thing I wanted to say is there's been some discussion of this question of why is the value of the acceleration c times h naught? Okay, and this is something that I thought we explained really well, well over a decade ago. It's not a surprise. So we'll do this less just in lambda CDM. It actually is even prettier in SIDM, but it'll take a longer time. If you go to the central parts of the halo and ask what is the acceleration, it's just 2 pi g rho s rs. Okay, that's rho s and rs as the NFW scale parameters. You'll remember that these things are set by when halo collapses. Right? It's the mean density related to when the halo is collapsed. That's related to the critical density. If you just go ahead, and everyone's can do this, just go ahead and plug the formula in, plug the numbers in, that's what you're going to get. All of the redshift dependence is now encapsulated in this mass, M200. Okay, it has this dependence raised to the 0.2, but the key thing is that that number comes out because the density of the halos is essentially set by the mean density when the universe collapses, right? I mean, you're welcome to go back and look at this paper. It's phrased in a different way, but this is the argument. Okay? And I just, yesterday evening, I just did this again and got that, C times H naught. It's just not that, there's a very reasonable explanation for why the acceleration is what it is. I mean, it just comes from hierarchical structure formation.
Okay.
is changed when you allow SIP input to COVID, right?
So yes, and that's exactly the, so if you, this is a great point. So this is what I wasn't going to go into, but if you notice that this is 10 to the minus, this is 10 to the minus 10, that's around there, right? And it's clearly not right, because there are galaxies where the total acceleration is much lower. You can do the same thing in SIDM, and you'll get an answer that's actually almost completely independent of mass, and it lies here. And the reason SIDM works is because whenever you see an acceleration that's up here, you can only get up there because the baryons are important. And if the baryons are important, then the baryons dictate, you know, how you move from here to there, because it's the e to the minus phi baryons that helps, that matters. If you didn't take into account the potential of the baryons, you would lie here in SIDM, 10 to the minus 11. Okay, and that's why it works. And so, you know, if you have another way of making cores, for example, with feedback, where you correlate the feedback or the size of the core with the stellar mass, then you're going to get some very similar things. Okay. So I want to say two things about a region where I didn't go, which was the dwarfs. One is that it's actually very interesting that the predictions become very, very insensitive to the cross-section. This is from Elbert et al. So this is James Bullock's group. I mean, Anika was on the paper. And what they're showing here is this is basically systems not within the Milky Way, but it's outside the Milky Way. So it's sort of a local group, but they're not satellites. They're showing mass measurements. So this sort of this too big to fail kind of plot, V versus R. And these curves, you can't see from the back, but between the cyan and this magenta, you've gone a factor of 100 in cross-section, 100. And nothing much has changed. Okay, and there's a very good reason for it. It has to do with this, the temperature profile in CDM, is that once you get isothermal here, and you know, increasing the cross-section makes more and more of this region isothermal, but this is already more or less isothermal. Right, so you don't really change anything. So it becomes sort of insensitive to what the cross-section is. And I think, in a sense, that makes things more robust, which is sort of the idea in this paper. Okay, and you can sort of see that in the densities. You're barely changing by a factor of two. Right? Same thing happens in the and this is sort of one of the papers that actually revived SIDM, Vogelsberger, Zavala, Loeb, and Vogelsberger, Zavala, Walker. This is just showing the too big to fail. Now, this is in the halo. So this is dwarf satellite galaxies within the Milky Way halo. This is 10 centimeters square per gram. But if you did this for one or three, it'll look pretty much the same. Okay. I'd say maybe I'll stop with this slide. It's in a lot of ways, what you're doing is sort of heat transfer in SIDM. When you do feedback, similar things happen. This is something that Haibo pointed out to me, which is that it's kind of interesting if you look at what the feedback models do, which is when you make these big cores, what it does, so this is from one of the Niehaus simulations, you make these big cores with the feedback, and you can get sort of the big things right. Well, what ends up happening is you rarely get the small, these dense things right. And that's, I think, fundamentally because you're not getting the sizes of the systems right. This huge feedback doesn't care about stars or dark matter. They're all collisionless. They're going to push everything out.
Okay, but no, these are data, right? There's no...
These are the sort of outliers in the Oman et al.
I don't see any Mika.
This is this.
Yeah, there's none with the core of 8 kiloparsecs.
Well, yeah. Yeah, nothing maybe that big. But they're still making pretty big cores. I'm just saying, like, when they make those big cores, what happens is you don't make the sizes, the small sizes, right? And so this is an interesting thing. You know, our rotation curve is going to be useful in the future. I think this is the kind of place to push, because this is physics, right? I mean, you're pushing things, the dark matter out. You should push the stars out too. Okay, so let me end with there. And what I've tried to tell you is that there's a very simple way to preserve all the success of the lambda CDM and explain the distribution of dark matter in the inner parts of galaxies. As far as I can tell, every single thing we've looked at, it's roughly consistent with this picture. I think the place where we need to push is the smallest guys, the ultrafains. That's the test bed for these models. Thank you for listening.
So two questions. One is, when you show this impressive agreement with Baryonic Tully Fisher and MDAR and so on, so a lot of these observations are in the regime that, as you say, where the baryons dominate. So in that regime, well, the SIDM is very similar to CDM because the dynamics are dominated by the baryons. Mm-hmm. So where does the SIDM test really apply? I mean, I agree at 50 kilometers per second, most of the data are at 100 and above, where it's really baryons that are responsible for the dynamics.
I think so, sort of in this range, you're talking about these systems, right? When the baryons end up dominating, this does end up looking like CDM, but in the sense of CDM, meaning they actually end up looking more like NFW halos,
yeah,
right, with no feedback kind of thing, right? But the neat thing is that for these systems, it correctly predicts that the sizes of the cores is like big, like RS, right? So it's this interpolation from here to there, right? If it wasn't for this baryonic, if it wasn't for this e to the minus phi, the SIDM model is a non-starter, right? It wouldn't explain any of these guys.
Yeah.
So you know, in a way, it's sort of interesting, right? It's because of this e to the minus phi baryons that's actually works at any level.
Can I ask you a supplementary question? Very simple. So when you say you look at the ultrafaints, fine. But if there's a discrepancy here, you have another freedom, not just the value of the cross section, but how it scales with velocity. So this is all for a constant cross sigma v, is that right? But what stops me from saying, I don't agree, I'm going to change the dependence of...
I think it becomes a much weaker argument. I mean, in principle, yeah, there could be some resonances at low velocities where the cross section get jacked up, but most of the things that people have written down, I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. The cross section, it tends to get like what I showed you at the beginning, like this. Which is not to say that they're like you're alluding to the fact that, you know, out here, what happens if you drop the cross section or something like that? Yeah, maybe. But I would say at that point, it's much less interesting because the whole point of this is one number and you see all of the small scale things, you know, being related to each other, right? The too big to fail, the core cards, they're all not different things. They're all the same things, but on different scales. So that is compelling for me. I wouldn't be very that interested.
So if I were to choose one parameter to modify CDM, I probably would choose the kind of numbers you're talking about. Now, how does this affect like other things like direct embedded detection, you know, indirect detection, you know, subhalos? Or I mean, does this change dramatically the way in which we should be looking for dark matter in non-astrophysical, you know, evidence for it?
I mean, subhalos, it's not 100% clear to me. How badly the disk affects, but if it's really like you guys are saying, it's all things that are along the line of sight, then I say it doesn't have to affect it very much, because a lot of the models that Hypo can speak up to, but a lot of the models people have written down, the cutoff scale might be 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses.
What about the internal dynamics of like ultrafaints and things we can do with
that? I think that is the key thing. But again, the predictions are not quite there. So hopefully we can do this before the dispersions of all the ultrafaints are measured. But I think it's a tricky one, right? Because the one thing that's been bothering me is like all of these ultrafaints seem very close to their pericenter. I'm not sure any longer that you're actually catching them in equilibrium. Like they might be in equilibrium if you let them go to the epicenter, but if you catch them at the pericenter, what should the predictions be?
I don't know. Seems very unlikely to me, but...
I know, but that's what it looks like with the Gaia data, right?
Well, no, that's for some models of them. I mean, what we observe is a velocity, an instantaneous velocity in position of the satellites.
Exactly.
The prediction for pericenter and epicenter require a model for the mass of the
way,
which, you know, may be reasonable, but it's not unique.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other questions from Manoj?
Wow.
Okay, let's thank him again.